rewind.
The Hungry Jacks Grand Final Series 2018 continues. David Anderson, the 37-year-old veteran. Drimmick to Creek and Ramon Moore on the charge. But what sort of shot? Anderson, Prather, the seconds expire. Casey Prather and Melbourne United stay in the fight and deliver a big blow. Shorter gave it a good look. Deng makes sure he gets another look. And this time, it's all good. In hope that it finds Casey Prather. Casper Weir.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. It is NBL Rewind. Hashtag NBL Rewind to get involved. And you should have already, however you get your content, at NBL, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Twitch, NBL TV, a grand final series that, Liam, you and I have spoken a hell of a lot about. They finally, Melbourne United, get the job done over Adelaide, five-game series. But game three was huge for about a million different reasons. Like, there was a headbutt thrown into this game, which always, you know, really gets the interest up and about. But a man who was critical in the fourth quarter is the man who's about to join us. He's not even retired yet. He's just chilling to see what's going to fall out. But what a remarkable 20 years it has been. I'm excited, Liam. It's fair to say. Because we are all about the same genre as well. So you and I watch this guy kill us in juniors and then just travel around the world and kill everyone else. So hello to you, Liam.
Yeah, nah. Thanks, Cam. Great to have the big fella with us. One of the absolute all-time greats of Aussie hoops and spent a little time in the NBL, grabbed some silverware and still doing his thing after all this time. So looking forward to it.
David Anderson, DA. Hello to you, my man.
G'day. How you doing, guys?
I'm doing really well. So much going on. We're going to get into what a career it has been. But firstly, 2020, we always touch base. It's been crazy for so many. How has it been for you and your fam?
I mean, it's been good with the family and stuff, obviously, because we've been in lockdown, so we spend a lot of time with each other. So kind of great to reconnect, especially last few seasons being in Wollongong, a bit more stressful. But yeah, I wouldn't say the corona's been a great thing. I mean, obviously, it's tough on a lot of people around here. And, you know, it does help with the family time and all that. But obviously, in the basketball world, it's not very friendly because no one can really play or get amongst it or train or play. And it's everyone's future's a bit up in the air. So, yeah, it's been a testing time, but obviously, I'm seeing the positive in it.
Hey, just, just on that, Liam and I have been in lockdown, can't even get haircuts. We look like...
Me either, mate.
So cool, man. And you still look so cool, even though you look like it's been a while since you had a trim.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I've grown it long out. You know, it's going with the Viking bun. So it's been, yeah, it's been hard. It's testing. I mean, lost my camera. Can't really do too much in that sense. So I've been trimming my son's hair as well. But it's interesting times, let's put it like that.
How's the farm gone, mate? Restrictions are lifting and you've been able to get out there?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, obviously, I run a big business out there, so I've been fortunate to be able to get out and control that, put a lot of energy into that because obviously, basketball world shut down. So, but yeah, that's been a big thing for me, trying to get that business operating, and I've been doing good. So, it's it's wet, let's put it like that. It's been a wet season.
And you've been getting some shots up?
Yes, I have. Unfortunately, you can't get down to local Frankston Stadium where I'd love to be shooting hoops. But fortunately, here I've got a little hoop set up outside, which I get on with my little man Arlo and do some shots and try and keep a little bit of touch in the times we can. But everyone tells me it's a bit like riding a bike, and I feel like that. I go away from it for a couple months and then I come back and start smacking threes like it's no problem.
I got to say, DA, we very rarely have pre-production meetings for NBL Rewind, but with you, we had to because there is a million different things we could have started at. We're going to start in Europe. We're going to start at the Olympics. We're going to start at the NBA. We're going to start the NBL, which started your career and where you currently are. And we ended up landing after flipping a coin on this grand final series just quickly. The game we just played.
Fair enough.
Evenly poised, one apiece, you go home for game three and fourth quarter, you come up with some huge buckets. As you look back, not just on this particular game, but the series that netted a championship at the end of it, what's your first thought?
Well, I mean, it was tough. And, you know, we had a couple big games. I remember game one was a real fight. And then we came over the line and we went to Adelaide and it was a tough one there. Obviously, we didn't get the win and we felt a bit robbed a bit by the rest, but I won't go into that. We came back to Melbourne and obviously you got the pressure on you because if you lose another one, then they've got the thing. And yeah, obviously, screws tighten a bit. Everyone gets a bit clammy, but you know, we went to the fourth quarter. It was a bit of a close game, obviously, and that's where I want to step up and shine a bit. So came out, hopefully helped out the team, put some big buckets on there, and obviously I think the rest of the team carried it into the end. So it was, it's one of those things. You want to help out and contribute as much as you can. And that year was a tough year, obviously, getting into it. So, but the Adelaide series was tough. I mean, it went all the way to 5 games, as you guys know. And we came away as champions, but definitely entertaining, I believe, for the fans.
DA, we've heard from your teammates from that team and the coaching staff, Vico, about the impact that you had on that team. But it'd be interesting to hear it from you. You know, like this is a Melbourne United franchise that had some talented rosters for a number of years and hadn't been able to get it, you know, win finals and get it done. They bring Vico in. You're a big part of the puzzle. What impact do you feel like you had on that group on and off the floor over the course of that championship campaign?
Well, I mean, I still remember sitting down with Larry and Vince before I signed, before Rio Olympics, and they were like, we know you like the talisman for, you know, winning championships and we want a championship here, so we're willing to obviously give you a deal and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, don't worry, Larry, I'll get you the chip. Don't worry, mate, we'll get it. It took another season than expected. But, I feel like obviously in the team sport, a lot of it's culture and it's all of it's building and obviously chemistry. You can have a very talented team, and I've been on very talented teams where we didn't win and didn't reach expectations. So that's the big thing. And obviously we did have a great team. We were very deep. We had a lot of good players that probably could have started and played more minutes on other teams. But we all clicked together really well. And there was a good, belief in each other. I mean, we weren't all best mates off the floor or anything like that. But, you know, part of it is we were all pros and we went about jobs, you know, every night. And Vico did a good job of making sure everyone was held accountable and doing their work. But, it just everything clicked really well, I thought, that year. And obviously the championship was the outcome of it.
How big was it for you personally? Of course, to win everywhere around the world, but to come here to the NBL and get that NBL championship, how big was it just from a personal perspective?
It was big. It's always in the back of my mind, being overseas for many years, especially playing my trade in Europe. I suppose you get a bit flown under the radar a lot, so coming back home, it was a time when obviously the NBL was on the up as well. I feel like there was a lot more eyes on it. That's one of the reasons why I came back to Australia, was to try and get the NBL moving in a better direction. And obviously one of the big parts of that is winning a championship. So for me, it was a key piece in my career. I've obviously won many chips along the way, but yeah, I thought it just, it was the icing on the cake, I suppose.
Let's take it back. Let's take it way back. You mentioned Frankston Stadium before, mate, the mayor of Frankston, the pride of the Frankston Blues, your good self. Battling it out with you in juniors. I can remember us Melbourne Tigers trying to get you to come across at some point.
Yeah, true. There was a little bit of talk of that.
Typical Melbourne Tigers juniors.
The Blues had you in that CBA program very early on. They'd worked out what to do. What, take us back to those early days and your love for playing for
the Blues and that. Well, I mean, it all started out under 12s, actually. That's where I won my first championship. Funnily enough, under 12s, reserves, A for reserves, I think it was. And we won the championship. I was obviously 11 or whatever. And my good mate, Dave Hankin, who I'm still good friends with, best man of the wedding and everything. We had a great time. We obviously won the chip there. And that was one of many to come. But yeah, with the Blues, obviously they did. They were instrumental. They got me into the ABA program, or CBA back then it was called. And then we had a great team of full of older veterans and stuff. And I remember the two American imports, Troy Muhlenberg and Albert Springs. I used to roll with them to the trainings all the time. So I used to learn a lot. And Troy Muhlenberg actually taught me quite a lot. He was after school 2 days a week. I think the Victorian Intensive Training, you know, program funded it, that he'd work me out 2 times a week. So he used to come to my school. We'd work out for an hour. Then we'd go to the gym and do some weights and stuff. And then we go along to the men's basketball practice. So it was a great steep learning curve for me, but it was great. It opened up the insight in how to be a pro or semi-pro because, you know, Troy and Albert were just living over here doing their thing. And, yeah, I learned a lot in those years. And afterwards, obviously, it flowed on to the AIS.
So just based on that, there's always times where it sort of clicks in your own mind that you can make a career out of a certain sport, and this, of course, being basketball. It sounds like pretty early on in your, I don't know how old you were, 13, 14, 15. Yeah, pretty early on you thought this is going to happen or can happen.
Well, I mean, no, to be honest with you, I didn't think I would be a pro. I mean, when I remember dealing with Troy and Albert, and they were talking about college. They obviously were college players. They played there 4 years, got their scholarship, came over here, and they were semi-pro. So, I mean, it never really entered my mind to be a pro until probably last year at the AIS. I mean, I was thinking along those lines when even before I went to the AIS, I was thinking, well, oh, I could maybe get an education out of this, go to college in America, get an education. That was the next step or progress for me, I suppose, is the way I put it. And then afterwards, it came to my light that, oh, maybe I can go, you know, become a pro. So it was one of those things, you know. For me, I always say it was an evolution. I never thought when I was 10 or 11, mm-hmm. bang, I'm going to be a pro. I'm going to play for Australia. I'm going this. I've told many times to many interviewers, like, you know, if you told me this 20 years ago, I would have been like, you're crazy, man. Get out of here.
In saying that, Liam, is it fair to say that the only person in the country who didn't think David Anderson was going to be a pro basketballer in 97 was Dave Anderson?
We all knew. We all knew. That's why we were trying to get him to come across.
You guys are too good.
Yeah, you mentioned being at the AIS. We could see just before over your left shoulder a little picture there on the
board. Oh, yeah. It's back.
We'll get you to see, take us through some of the memorabilia a little bit later. But take us back to being at the AIS and the decision, like, okay, I'm going to turn pro. You would have had some big college offers, no doubt. Who mm-hmm. what opportunities did you have in the States, and which NBL teams were knocking on that door?
So, I mean, in the States, I had a couple of big teams like UCLA were pursuing me, Arizona with Luke Olsen, the late one. So they were big ones. And I never actually ventured to the point where I went over and did visits or anything like that. But I did obviously speak with some of the NBL teams then because they were obviously more keen, and my parents and I actually ended up settling on the Magic with Brian Gorgon back before that offseason. They merged with the Giants. So it actually, you know, it all turned around and it was an interesting, obviously very quick learning curve about professional basketball then, because I got squeezed out of the merger. And then I actually ended up going back to Wollongong, who were very interested in me at the start with Brendan Joyce and the Hawks. They were keen. They put a great offer on the table for me before that, but I decided to come home. But then, obviously, as things moved around, ended up back there for my first year as a pro. But in terms of college, it was pursued for me, but I got to admit, I wasn't much of an academic. I was very rebellious in that sense. But in saying that, I've learned a lot over my years and probably a bit more smarter in that sense, and hopefully influence my children that way. But no, it was a choice for me. It was to be in Australia and start to be a pro, I suppose, was the way I thought about it.
Just based on that Magic situation, and then you touch on it, that you learned pretty quickly a little bit about pro basketball. Do you reckon that changed your perception or the way you went about certain things and have gone about it, you know, decisions or conversations or contract dealings with or whatever it might be over the next 2 decades?
A little bit. I mean, obviously, you got to put things in perspective a bit. You can't get too emotional about it or anything like that. I mean, it was a bit of a shock and, you know, kind of threw a spanner in the works. But you kind of realize that things work out in the long run, and you've just got to make the most out of every opportunity. So for me, it threw me off. It meant I wasn't going to be at home. I was moving further away from home after living in the AIS for 2.5 years. I was moving further to Wollongong, but I've got a great support. Like, my family is very supportive, my brothers and sisters, obviously now my wife and kids and everything. But it's one of those things. You just got to deal with what they throw at you. And I felt I did a good job of, you know, just moving on with it and finding the best opportunity, which was in Wollongong.
Who'd they go with? Was it your mate from the state teams, Brad Sheridan?
Raddy was a part of it. Yep, he was already thing. But the bigs were, I think it was Wheeler and Pepper. Pepper came across from the Giants. Wheeler was already with the Magic. And I think there was obviously, I think, Ronaldson. I'm not sure. it's going back a bit. You're rattling my brains here with the memories. But so, yeah, it was interesting.
You make the move over to Europe, 18 years old, to head over to Bologna.
Yeah.
Let me ask this before we get stuck into your career over in Europe. How big has your Danish heritage been for you and your basketball career?
Well, it's helped a lot. I mean, obviously, my father's Danish. He came across, well, funny story, my mum and my dad, they're both European heritage. My mum's English, my father's Danish. They met in the middle of Australia at a roadhouse, which is pretty unheard of. And then kicked it off and ended up going back to Europe, getting married, and decided to return to Australia to settle down with the family. And obviously, I'm one of five kids, so quite a big family. But yeah, and in Denmark, my father is one of 12 kids. So I have over 100, and I think there's 145 cousins and, you know, second cousins, that kind of thing, in the northern parts of Denmark, in near Aalborg. And I've been there quite a few times, obviously now a lot more than a lot of my brothers and sisters. But yeah, it came about obviously when the European Union came to fruition in 2000, you know, and people were talking about it and how you can obviously do a lot more in Europe if you have a passport. So we pursued that while I was at Wollongong with the help of my auntie, who's been like probably a second mum to me. And yeah, it came to fruition. I got the Danish passport. And when I was signed over in Italy, it helps you. You play like a local over there, essentially, and you have coverage for healthcare and all that kind of stuff. So it was a big part, and I'm proud to say that I'm Danish. And it was funny because the first thing, as soon as they saw that I petitioned for a passport and I talked about signing in Bologna, the Danish national team came a calling straight away and was like, oh, are you going to sign? Are you going to play with us? We need you. You know, we're trying to get to the European championships and all this. And I was like, I've already played for Australia in the junior levels and everything. So I'm by national right, I'm Australian by basketball. So, which is probably better because obviously I wouldn't have seen any Olympics. I don't feel
thank with goodness Denmark. For that.
Yeah. All Boomers fans are extremely happy. That was the situation that played out. Just on that. So you're at Wollongong and you're going through the process you touch on. You talk about the fact of, you know, you're moving a little, you're in Canberra, now you're moving to Wollongong, a little further away from Melbourne. Italy's a long way away. So how does this all work out? What is it, you know, was it financially motivated? Was it the fact to try new things? Was it just the opportunity to play at a club like the ones that were chasing you?
Bologna? Well, it's all of the above, Cameron. Yep. It's like, obviously financially they offered me, I believe it was huge. It was like a $2 million deal for over four or five years back then, which was massive. And it was Kinder Bologna, which is, it was the premier team in Europe or Euroleague even back then. So it was like, it was a huge opportunity. And, obviously me, I've been traveling with the junior teams quite a bit because I've been doing Albert Schweitzer tournament under 16s when I was bottom age. Under 18s, top age. With the junior team, I travelled even during the Wollongong, my first year in Wollongong. It was, so I was quite, you know, open to culture and stuff like that. So, but in saying that, moving to Italy is daunting to live professionally and be there in that scenario. So I was fortunate. Like I said, my family is very supportive. My brother, Stuart, who 1 year older than me, grew up playing basketball against him, obviously, and playing blues with him and everything. He said he'd come across and live with me, kind of like.
I bet he did.
Yeah. So the team worked out a little salary for him. We incorporated it into the contract. So, and basically, yeah, I had very good agents.
Bloody oath, still, he did.
Still with the same agent as we speak. So Kenny Grant and Leon Rose, they were very good. They helped me out a lot. So we got him a little bit of money to live with me, a monthly kind of thing. And then he just basically, it was a sounding board for me to talk to and to work out with and do things with and obviously helped me adjust to the life over there. So it was an interesting time. And obviously he just, I suppose, acclimatized me a bit easier to the Italian way of life. I helped him out. Obviously, we went out. We had a lot of good funs together and good times. And, yeah, obviously, I think that helped me a lot in my adjustments.
What are your most treasured memories of those years in Bologna? You're winning Euro leagues. An amazing way to start a career.
It was crazy. I mean, obviously, the first year I was there, it was a bit of a letdown, I suppose. It was a learning curve for me, and I was quite, I got a lot of opportunity. But we had a stacked team. Everyone thought we were going to win the EuroLeague and be like better than anything I mean, supporter cup. But we kind of disappointed a bit, and the coach was obviously a bit testing times for that. But then the next year, we actually got new ownership and they went another level. We got a younger team and some real good pieces around it. And we ended up winning. That was the King's Cup, they call it. We won the Italian League, the Euro League after the Italian League. Italian Cup, sorry, is the mid-season competition. Then we won the Euro League and then we won the Italian League. So we won everything you could possibly win that year. And one of the craziest memories I have is when we won the Euro League, basically it was a 5-game series because back then it was the first year of the Euro League and we went to, it was against Tau Vitoria, which they were one of the other premier teams from Spain. And we basically went all the way, 5 games. We lost the first one even, I think, and then 2 games. Then we won 2 in a row. Then we lost the fourth one away, came back to Bologna for game 5. And ended up winning, like, you know, it was a close game, 8 points or something in the end. But the thing I remember most was literally the siren went and the crowd just rushed the floor. Like, it was like a riot almost. Like, you know, literally, I was on the bench when the siren went and we all just ran for the locker room, past the scorers board into the locker room. And within like 30 seconds, they were up cutting the nets down. The fans were jumping on the rings. Chants were going crazy. Flares were getting set off. And basically, like within, I think it was about 5 minutes later, Marco Jaric walks in and one of the guards, he was on the floor when the siren went. He came back in literally in just his jock strap. He had like, and his shoes on. They took his jersey off him, his shorts, everything. It was crazy. They were just going nuts and they were just chanting away. And we were in the locker room just celebrating and popping champagne and going nuts. And they're just singing outside our windows because they're all like, it's in Cassis Stadium. And they're just chanting all the songs and we're throwing out like socks through the windows and they're going nuts every time we give them a sock or something like that. And it was no real big, I don't believe, like a big ceremony. I think it took them ages to clear the floor so we could just get our like trophies and stuff. But huge game and we won in Bologna. So after the game, after it all settled down, we went downtown and the crowd, the people just riding around on scooters, just beeping horns. It was like New Year's Eve all over, firecrackers going off.
Did this surprise you? Like I know once you've been over there for a couple of seasons, you see the fanatical, passionate fans. Mm. But when you first left the NBL and went over there, did you have any idea this is what it could be like?
I mean, I knew I'd seen it a little bit, like, you know, playing national team a little bit, mm-hmm. but not to this level. I mean, Bologna was huge. There was a rivalry there that was like, you know, it's crazy. You got 42 and keen to Bologna. And they were like the two biggest budgets when I got to Europe. So that was like massive. We beat them in the semifinals to go to the finals that year. And it was phenomenal. So you get used to that a bit. They used to chant at me. I think I've said this before. They used to call me Cangorino di Merda at 42. Though. So every time I catch the ball, you know, you had 6,000 fans just screaming, Cangorino di Merda, vaffanculo, which means like kangaroo, piece of shit kangaroo. Fuck you kind of thing. So I was like, you know, thing, but then you hit a jump shot and they all go quiet and that makes you feel good. So it was nuts. So you get used to, you know, they throw coins at you, they swear at you. In Greece they'll spit on you, do everything, you know. So I'm pretty level-headed when I'm on the court, and it never really got to me too much, but yeah, some people get pushed back by it and get a bit of, you know, afraid of it, but for me it was just gave me excitement.
So fair to say, when you roll in the Perth Arena, it doesn't matter what NBL jersey you got on and they're going booing you, you don't care as long as you're not throwing missiles at you or ash or smoking in your face.
Exactly. Not too bad. But I mean, in saying that, Perth do have a pretty hostile environment. There's always this one heckler in the background too that gets to, he just sits there just constantly hounding, which is interesting. I mean, you do it in Europe, they can't really understand him. But yeah, you got that bloke in you, it's kind of funny. But no, it's fun. And like, it's not the same hostile environment, I suppose, in Europe. Like in Europe, they're just, I mean, it's different nations too. So you don't know like the history of like people might be coming to the game, like thinking, oh, we're going to kill these Spanish team, you know, when you're playing EuroLeague because they're Italians or German playing against Russia or this kind of thing. So it's, I'm sure some of the fans vent their anger out through the sports world.
tell us about a young man, Ginobili.
Ah, he was a freak. I mean, He was good. Like, he came to us and he wasn't really known. Like, you know, he was playing in Reggio Calabria the season before and we beat them in the playoffs. But he performed out of this world in that playoff series. We went all the way to 3 games with them and was going back and forth. But anyway, we beat him. And then that following season, he came across to us as a player. And he really, like, took off that offseason, I feel. Like, he came in and one of our stars, Saša Danilović, kind of was, you know, he was on the cusp of retiring and didn't really feel for it too much. And I think, you know, he saw Manu where he was and kind of just said, oh, well, you know, and I think something happened there. But Manu was phenomenal. He just, you know, in training sessions, I just love playing, you know, love, hate playing against him too, because he'd come down the lane at you and he'd do this, you know, snaky sidestep around. And you'd be like, I've got him. I'm set up. I'm taking this charge. And he'd just snake around you and lay it up on the other side. And you'd be like, how the hell did he get around me? And you'd be like, dude. And so by the end of the season, I just resorted to fouling him every time he came in the lane. I'd just take an arm off and be like, nah, go on the free throw line. But yeah, he was great to play with. Real humble guy too. Like, he could have been, you know, being a bit of a dick about things because he was killing the EuroLeague. He made the MVP that year. He was scoring a lot in the Italian league. You know, he had huge things and he could have gone NBA, I believe, straight after that season, but he stayed for another year. But really good guy, just humble, went about his business, never like said anything like, oh, I need more shots. I never heard those words come out of his mouth. He just was all about winning as well. And I think that's, it's a bit in the Argentinian mentality, I feel too, because I've played with another guy, Luis Scola, another Argentinian, same, similar kind of mentality. So it's it was great to be a part of that guy's career. And then to see him doing it in the NBA kind of made me feel better when I saw you doing those snaky kind of things. And I didn't have to be like, oh, it wasn't just me getting fooled. It was some of the best guys in the world.
You know what they did over there? They just resorted to fouling him.
Nah, yeah. Smart people, man. That's a scout.
It sounds like you're almost the first DA to be exposed to the Eurostep, which is now obviously something that every player almost in all around the world has part of their repertoire.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, that's back then. It was a bit.
You were calling it a traveler practice.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I was asking for it, swearing at the assistant coaches. Come on, man, it's a travel, and they would never call it. But nah, he was good.
It was during this time with Bologna that you got drafted.
That's correct.
The NBA. Talk us through the draft process. What do you remember about all of that?
Well, I mean, I was always on the draft radar. I remember hearing about it, that I was pretty high up and blah, blah, blah. But obviously, I didn't get that high, obviously, is what I wanted to. But I played, obviously, I was 2002. I got drafted, so I was at 22, which is the eligible age you have to wait for. Well, that year we didn't win the EuroLeague or anything, but the season went late. I remember it was a late off season. And then we, obviously, I went across and I did some workouts over there with a couple of people in Chicago. I worked out there and did in Orlando and a couple of things. And then it was off season. So I was away. I was on holiday and stuff when the draft went on. And I didn't know, there was no expectation I was going to go high either. Like, you know, no one was like, it's not like now or Bogues when he went number one a few years later. But yeah, I didn't know what would happen. And funnily enough, I was just, I was chilling out. I was on holiday and I remember watching it a little bit and being a bit disappointed when your number doesn't get called. And then eventually got called in the second round to Atlanta Hawks. And yeah, basically my agent called me and said, yeah, they've drafted you, blah, blah, blah. You've still got contracts in Europe. Obviously you can pursue the NBA if you want, but you know, everything happens in September, October with the NBA. And you're obviously, your European seasons all start up in July, August. So he's like, you're going to have it's going to be hard for you to work something out. And if you're not getting anything guaranteed, he was kind of like, stay in Europe, you're earning good money, you're winning championships, you're maturing more over there. I think it's better. So for me, the NBA kind of went on the back burner a bit as I pursued more, you know, more glory in Europe and I started to step up. Probably the biggest calling card was for Europe was, for the NBA would have been after my 2004 season with Siena. I was the MVP of the final series. We won our first championship there. And then I was thinking about making a move to the NBA and they were talking about doing a trade and stuff like this and it happened. But then, funnily enough, I got a huge offer from CSKA Moscow that time around. So it was like, oh, geez, what do you want to do? You want to hang out until September, give up all this money in this huge contract, go play for CSKA Moscow, or do you sign and keep chasing chips. And I was like, well, I'm going to be a pro and start chasing these. So that's why I got held, put on hold a bit more.
Was there a time as you continue to do exactly that, dominate, win championships and make potloads of cash, was there a time where you thought to yourself, the NBA won't happen? And you've made that decision. So was it like, you know, I may never play in the NBA?
Yeah, it was a bit. I mean, I admit, like, you know, obviously I never really, it never entered my mind that I was going to be an NBA player or star. But it did, obviously, when I was in Cessna, I was starting to win. And then, but then I went through an injury, massive injury, and a lot of people thought I'd be done. That was career-ending. But testament to all my support network and my trainers and everyone, I got back on court and I was back playing at the top level. And then, there was opportunities. But like I said, every off-season, I was given more by my teams in Europe. Like, you know, stay here, play here. We'll give you more money. We'll, you chase this, you know. And it's kind of like, I'm not going to go for a minimum in Atlanta when I can earn a truckload more here. And it wasn't happening much. It wasn't much European influence as there is nowadays. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't huge. And then, so it wasn't until Barcelona when I moved out of Moscow, got to Barcelona and had a great season there as well. We went Final Four. I did great there. We won the championship in Spain. And then I was like at 28, 29 years old, I was like, nah, I feel like I've banked enough. I've set myself up. I'm really good. I'm in a good spot. I think it's time to make a trip. And luckily enough, my agents did a great job working, mustering together a deal with Houston, and it worked out to a pretty good deal. So it wasn't too big a hit.
Just with the European stuff and big money and new offers, like, do you ever get surprised that a bigger offer comes? So you play so particularly well in some place, you win a championship, you're MVP. Mm-hmm. And then an offer comes and you pretty much do the same thing at a new club. And then another bigger offer comes. You ever sit back and go, I'm surprised that the bigger offers continue to come. Like, are they way bigger? Like, I'm not saying like enough to make you change clubs.
Yeah, no, sometimes. I mean, obviously Moscow were the top of the tier. I feel like I did actually leave Moscow. They offered me a bigger deal, but I went to Barcelona, more of a lifestyle and change. And obviously it had been 4 years, hard years in Russia. Obviously the cold and the weather wears on you, but Sexy do a great job of making you feel comfortable, and I had a great time there and obviously won a lot. But then so I moved to Barcelona for a lifestyle thing. And then it is hard when you're getting the best of the best throwing you. I mean, you're talking about Moscow, you're talking about Barcelona, these great cities to live in as well. So and you get treated like a superstar, so it is hard. But, it's one of those things you kind of rattles. When I think back and I go to the cities I lived in, I'm very fortunate for sure.
This is part of the reason why you are the most underappreciated, out-and-out absolute champion of Australian basketball, because you're talking about your time playing for CSKA Moscow, one of the biggest clubs in the entire world, mm-hmm. and you say lines like, obviously, we won a lot. You won EuroLeague. You won two EuroLeagues in those 4 years. You won domestic title and domestic cup after title after cup.
Yeah.
What?
Didn't miss one.
So underappreciated the amount of winning you did over the course of the career. But let's zero in on this time with Moscow, because all EuroLeague first team in your first season there.
Yeah, that was first year.
And then those two EuroLeague titles in 06, 08. What are your overriding memories of playing for that massive club?
Well, I mean, it's great. Like I said, they're probably one of the most professional clubs in Europe by far. And like, they compare to an NBA team, I'll put it like that. It's very not easy to play for them either, because there's so much pressure to win. Like in my first year there, like I say, I was EuroLeague All-Star 5, I think. And then we had the pressure of the Final Four was in Moscow that year. So they wanted to win it all real bad. And we didn't lose games. Like, I think we went on the biggest pro streak ever. It was like 35 games leading up to Christmas or something like this. And we were just smashing teams left, right and center. And it was great. You know, we're having a ball. But then fast forward to the actual Final Four, we come to the Final Four, it was in Moscow, and we lost in the semi-final to Tau Vitoria, who I've beaten previously. And it was just, it was devastating. Obviously, the whole team, the whole outlook, everything changed. Like, that's talking about pressure in Europe. That's big time pressure. When you play for Moscow and there's a Final Four in your home city, it was like everything was on the line. And unfortunately, it was one of those things we didn't get to play in. It was a different arena to what we played in all year. And we only trained on the floor once before the actual game, and we didn't shoot well. Guys didn't do what they normally do, like it was Singh, and then they were playing really well too. Like, some of their guys had outstanding games, and it was just, it was one of those things. It was the compounding problem of every little thing that could have gone wrong went wrong. So it was like, goddamn. And then, like I said, it was like a massive dark day in Russia for that. But then after that, we obviously end up winning the Russian Cup that year and the Russian League, but it was regarded as a black year. They just didn't want to forgive. So they changed up the coach. I mean, they changed up a lot of the players. They brought in Messina, who I've been with in Italy before. And then they brought in a couple other players who I'd actually played with too. And yeah, the whole squad changed around. And then we end up turning around the next year. We win everything. So you get these sways and stuff like that. And it's hard, you know, with that team, because obviously you lose a couple games and everyone's on you pretty hard. But in saying that, that taught me a lot of, I suppose, focus and commitment to winning, and you start to build up good habits. And obviously winning is a habit. You got to learn all the little intricate things and remain focused all the time, because you can get carried away. You can party too much. You can do too many things. But we had a really good team. And obviously that next year we won. And then the next year we come back. We didn't win the final EuroLeague that following year in 07. But then 08, we win again. So it's... yeah, fond memories from there. And obviously, I suppose Moscow is a crazy city to live in too. Like, it's expensive as hell. Like, to put things in perspective, like, CSKA get us an apartment, and there was two or three of my other teammates that lived in it. Previous teammate was there before I got there. And the rent on it was like over $20,000 US a month. So it is ridiculous. Like, it's expensive as hell. And obviously, you come there and you're like, what the hell? And the team's taking care of everything. They get you a driver. They're looking after you. You're living a different life. Like, it's nothing I've ever seen or never would have thought of coming from Frankston. And then you go there and it's crazy. So, and you're getting looked after. You go to the fancy restaurants. But it was funny. One of my friends, his American counterpart, who did a lot of dealings in Russia with the mining and stuff like that. He's from Duke University. And he said, it's like, the way he explains it to Americans, it's like Miami, LA, New York all rolled into one. And it's a bizarre world. I mean, it's very cold. That's what wears on you, the winter and all that. Russian people can be a bit standoffish until you get to know them. And then they're very open and very friendly. But yeah, CSKA as a team were amazing for me. And obviously I'm very grateful. And I hope to go back there one day in the near future and see him and obviously catch a game of theirs. Cause I'm still following them. They're winning EuroLeagues. They're still doing great things. But for me, the life there was, it was something to treasure. And there's a ton of stories I can tell, but obviously we don't have too much time.
We do.
We have plenty of time. We'll
see you today. That's what I told these guys. I said this to a lot of journalists back in the day. I said, you guys should have come over to Europe and visited me, or like, on a paid thing from Basketball Australia or something, I don't know, and just spent a week, even at the Final Fours, because it was like, it'll blow a lot of people's minds if they saw the things and the different lifestyle of the EuroLeague and the style you live in those cities.
Well, these are the Stephen Howes and the Grant Lee Bernards of the world at this point.
That's true. Exactly.
Liam and I spoke about this with Corey maybe 2 months ago now, talking about your career. And I actually think, had social media been more prevalent, if we had Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and whatever it might have been when you were doing these things, you would be by the neutral basketball fans, you know, people like Liam and I who live and breathe it almost on a daily existence. We understand, but the neutral basketball fans, if social media had been 10 years earlier, you would be held exactly where you deserve to be held in the minds of many.
It's probably true. I mean, I'm not huge on the social media thing. I mean, it is hard. It's a different era, I suppose, for people nowadays. I mean, everything's so unprivatized. Everything's in people's faces, and you're pretty much thrown into the whole thing, which is, it's not a bad thing, but it is obviously a different type of confidence for me. You know, back then it was totally different. So, but I was fortunate enough. I mean, I know no social media and all that, but when I talk to friends and I tell them stories and stuff, and they get amazed by it. And I was fortunate enough to share it with a lot of my family members, they always flew over and visited me. Not so many in Moscow because they were a bit scared. But then as soon as I moved to Barcelona, bang, it was like there was a schedule of all my family members coming to visit me. I was like, come on, like you didn't want to come to Moscow? In saying that, my parents and my wife obviously came and visited me and stuff like that. So it's great to be able to share those accomplishments and lifestyles with people close to you. So, but it would have been good to show some journalists.
It's a good point though, Cam, because the truth is it would have actually all been done for you.
Yeah, agreed.
Like, we would have been able to just watch the highlight reels, the little packages instantly of what you did overnight. And like, for instance, like Alex Marich, all Euro League first team.
He was killing it.
Like, people here don't appreciate how big time that is and how big he was, because like you, he was doing it over there in what was kind of the darkness for us back here.
Oh, he was huge. I was like, yeah, that's why I could not believe how much he didn't get nowhere near the love that he should have. He won championships. I remember him winning EuroLeague with Panathinaikos, and he got like, you know, not even a few lines in the paper and stuff. I'm like, man, do people know he just won the freaking EuroLeague? Like, that's the second best league in the world. I was up in arms with him. I was messaging him, telling him great job. And, you know, obviously we've been fortunate to share trips with the Aussie team and stuff like that. Yeah. We talk about it. And, yeah, I mean, I'm sure he still is obviously over the moon that he got to experience it all in person. But, but yeah, like the journeys that he's done. And obviously now we've got some guys applying their trade, like Brock's over there doing his thing and some others. But, you know, back then, like we had Matty Nielsen, me, Truck, I mean, Alex Marich. So, you know, Brad Newley started to get on the scene too. Like these guys, they all applied their trade and did a great job. And that's what I kind of preach to the young guys now. There's a whole world of basketball in Europe which is untapped. And you know, you can make huge coin over there, be very successful, even if not as much in America as you can in Europe. So it's one of those things. There is a big world. And obviously, I was fortunate to be a part of it and the high level.
Hey, DA, just on the domestic championships, and of which you've won heaps, we talk more about EuroLeague than anything else. Mm-hmm. Just from a club perspective, from a player's perspective, and from a fan's perspective, how highly they celebrated. You mentioned before when you didn't win EuroLeague, but you won the Russian Cup, that it was still considered not a great season by many. Yeah. The domestic grand finals and championships, how are they celebrated? Is it all geared towards qualifying for EuroLeague and winning that?
Well, it was in the early days. So when I first got to Europe, EuroLeague was obviously starting off then. And it was basically the top four teams, if I get it right, in Italy went to play in EuroLeague. Then the top four in Spain, top two in Greece, top Russian, top Israeli. I think there was one German team. Even one year there was an English team and a couple French maybe. But yeah, so it was all about if you won the domestic league, you would actually play EuroLeague or get to the semifinals. So there was a bit of pressure to do that. And in saying that, winning a domestic league, it's not bloody easy. Like, I mean, it's still huge. It's like winning NBL, like put in perspective, but even on steroids, because it's it's bigger teams, better budgets. So in saying that, CSKA always had the thing, like we kind of winning there was not as big as when we won in Italy. So in Italy, but when we won in Italy, like it was huge. Like, you know, it was celebrations like EuroLeague again. So, I mean, yeah, the whole town's getting thing. You're going to see the mayor of the city. They're giving you the keys to the city. You know, they're rolling out. The sponsors are putting on 12-course dinners for you and stuff like this. I mean, it's fun times. And, you know, to do it across various nations was quite obviously great to experience the different things. But, yeah, some of them were pretty big, but yeah, huge. The other side, the Italian Cup, it's a mid-season comp. So for the people who don't understand it, it's like you get the top eight teams or sometimes top seven plus a second division team. They come up, you go over a weekend, you play Thursday, Friday, and it's knockout. So top eight teams, Thursday, Friday, and then usually Sunday afternoon is the final. So you bang, 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 and it's like mid-season comp. There's a pause for a week or two of the domestic league, and off you go. And for a lot of teams, it's like they call it a consolation prize. So if you win that and then you don't win something else, then it kind of makes the season worthwhile, blah, blah, blah. But, I've won a few of those, and it's not – granted, it's not huge, but, I mean, it's still – it was great fun, and it's knocked out everything, and you have a big party at the end of it, and you enjoy it, and – Yeah, I remember in Italy one year it was in Forlì, which is south of Bologna, and we went to Milano Maritima as a team, which is on the coast of near Bologna, and they rented out a really nice restaurant. We were all popping bottles of champagne because you got to think, we're going back to work in 4 or 5 days' time to chase a EuroLeague, so it's not like you get carried away. But if a lower level team wins it, for them it's like, yeah, it's like hallelujah, we saved the day kind of thing. So, but fortunately, yeah, we won a few of those as well.
Just on that, and I think the NBL, we're going back to the 90s, had a midweek cup or a midweek comp for a year.
Yeah, might have been similar format.
Yeah, maybe not going into NBL 21 with all the uncertainty, but down to like 2-3 years away when we're all back to some type of normality, would you like to see that in the NBL? Would you like to see something mid-season trial, something like that?
I think it's a good thing. I mean, it creates a bit of interest, and I mean, everyone loves a celebration. So, you know, if you can get something and like it creates a little pause in the season, I think they did it also a little around like having that pause and stuff like that. So, and yeah, it's a celebration. So, and you can incorporate, like I said, in some leagues, they incorporated the second division because the second division in Europe is quite strong. It's a strong thing because you get the interchanging like football in, or soccer in Europe. They have two teams go up, one team goes down, this kind of constant interchanging. So in second division, the teams are actually not too bad. So they, one of the top teams played in the cup. So it was top 17 plus a cup. So, you know, it was a good opportunity for those second division teams to bang, you know, chip off a win against a top division team. So, and I think it creates more excitement, something to build towards. I mean, because it gets a bit of a slug in the middle of the season because you're playing so much and it's Europe and it's winter and, you know, it gets a bit of a grind. And then all of a sudden, come January, February, you got this cup to look forward to. Hmm. And for instance, in France, it's called the Leaders Cup, which is all done at Disney World up near Paris. So it wasn't the best. They construct this huge tent and you play on this floor and you go in there and it's the same top 18 or 17 plus one. And it's done over a weekend. It's called Leaders Cup. And you get a lot of, obviously, international, all the agents, all the, like, you know, the NBA agents are coming to look at all the talent that's there as well. And you get everyone in the same weekend in the same room. So it's quite a good way to bring everyone together. And it makes something to celebrate too. So we ended up, I won one of those with, who was that, with Strasbourg or something? I can't remember. So yeah, it was... it's a great thing to be around and obviously have fun with it.
You mentioned the move to Barcelona and everyone coming over to visit. My man Tommy Greer tells a story about how, or a bunch of stories about coming to visit you that year. It was the year before you went to the NBA. ACB champs, got a bunch of great teammates, Juan Carlos Navarro, fun team to be a part of. But he tells stories about you visiting you roll up to the club, just park right out the front. He said you ran Barcelona.
I wouldn't say that. Juan Carlos Navarro, he runs Barcelona. He's a man. He's a mayor of the place. Like, that guy is like, you need to do an interview with him one day if you can, because he was a man. Like, for him to do what he did, and I ran on him because he was a great teammate too, real good guy. He could score and do all the greats, and for him to stay in that club for as long as he did and win as much as he did, he was another guy who flew under the radar because of obviously different era and stuff like that, but you know, one of the greats. But no, Barcelona was a great city, and like I said, we did get a lot of visitors, and Tommy was one of them. He came over with a mate, and I took him out for dinner. We went out for dinner a couple of times, him, my missus and stuff. And yeah, we did go to the club and probably did. We get to get looked after. We park out front and walk in. Because they all know who you are. You're Football Club Barcelona. So, I mean, in saying that, football players, I don't even know. They went out a little bit, but they're so scrutinized that they couldn't probably let their hair down as much as we do as basketballers. So, yeah, we'd be out a bit. We had a youthful team and used to get amongst it. But the crazy thing in Spain and Barcelona, we'd play the games at like 10 o'clock at night, 9:30 at night. So you finish up at 11:30, you go to dinner, you're not going to the club till 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. And no one's in there if you do go there earlier. So you just end up rocking. So the nights get dragged out pretty late. So I think it might have been 6 a.m. finish with Tommy that night. But good times. And Barcelona was great because it is a very international city and everyone loves it. And it was actually good weather as we got to the end of the season. But there was very fond memories of that place.
So did you change your body clock when you go to a place like that? Were you having siestas? Did you just like immerse yourself in whatever the culture was of the team that you were in?
I'm a very chameleon type person. I can blend into any culture, which is probably one of my reasons why I'm being successful is my ability to do that. But yeah, when I got to Italy, I was all about the siestas and everything. I mean, saying that growing up, we still had siestas at RIS all the time, like when you could skip class and have a little snooze and stuff like that. But nah, we, Italy, adjusted there. Spain, you adjusted your clock. You had to, because otherwise you wouldn't socialize or do anything. But no, I was very flexible. And yes, the Spanish ways of life were totally different. I mean, you think of Australia, you know, we eat dinner at 6, 7 o'clock, you know, this kind of thing. In Spain, if you go to a restaurant at 7 o'clock, like literally they look at you and go, the chef is not in, he won't be in for 2 hours, you better turn around and get out of here. So that was is a different adjustment, but I was fine. I used to adjust fine to it, and the food saying that. So
hey, you just mentioned it just quickly, I don't think a lot of people realize, but the football club, the basketball club, it's all one club in Europe, isn't it? Like people, I don't think a lot of people realize that. So you roll in and say Barcelona, and you've got there's the football crew over there doing their thing, the women's football, our basketball. It's all one big club, isn't it?
It is, definitely, like Football Club Barcelona. So the big stadium, Camp Nou, is where we played our games too. So we have our basketball stadium, which we shared with handball and I think it was volleyball and some other. So, and then Camp Nou, where they played the football games, is right there, literally attached. So we were all involved. I mean, we didn't really socialise too much with the soccer team or anything like that. But there was a couple of times we flew back on the planes with them from Madrid. We had a cup in Madrid and they were playing Real Madrid and a huge game. And then they were on their private plane, which was huge. Like their plane was like a big 747. We flew back into Barcelona. They gave us some seats at the back of the plane because Messi and that were all up front. But they were all really cool, actually. When you meet them, like, you know, they're these huge profiles and everyone's a bit daunted by him. But then you go up, you meet him, you know, you shake, I shook Messi's hand and said hello. And, you know, he's just a tiny little fella too. But, you know, this is when they're great. And a couple of their guys are good. They have a good sense of humor. Piqueiro, I remember him just getting the microphone and doing some singing on the plane back and stuff like that. So it's fun to be around the different codes of sport, I suppose, and see how they act and stuff. Because they're usually really good people.
It's fair to say that you and Messi probably never hit the gym together. Is that true?
Nah, I'm not.
He's like similar, a guy like me. Gym's not something he looks big on.
Nah, he's probably not. But he's insane. He probably does do a bit. He's certainly doing his footwork drills and stuff like that. Because damn, he's fast. So but no, it was good times.
It was. You lost me, am I there?
Yeah,
you
got you.
Yeah. It was at this point you made the move to the NBA, Daryl Morey and the Rockets. Took less money to hit. You're playing for Cisco, you're winning Euro Leagues, you're playing for Barcelona. Why? How did they convince you to make that move? Why did you make that move at that point?
Well, like I said previously, like I was comfortable financially, obviously. I've been quite astute with my money. Testament to my parents' upbringing, they were very astute with the money and told me invest it all, don't blow it like other basketballers and buy all these Porsches and you know, spend all the money on the flancy things, invest it all, get into property, do the right thing. And I did that. So I was comfortable, especially once I got to Barcelona. I was like, nah, it's all right. And they did offer me more money to go back the following year because I had a great year. I remember seeing the general manager coming out of a concert in June, and there'd already been talk about what I was going to do. And he was like, oh, we want you back. You know, we want you back. We're going to win EuroLeague next year because we went to Final Four, but we didn't win. We're going to win EuroLeague next year. We've got a bigger budget. We're going to give a thing. I was like, yeah, it's okay. Talk to my agent. We'll see, blah, blah, blah. And it turned out it didn't eventuate. But my agents did a good job in getting a three-year deal with Houston Rockets. And I was like, mentally, if I don't go now, I'm 29. I don't think I'll ever go. And I was like, it was always in my mind. I remember back to when I was young, I wrote down on my, you know, wardrobe when I was a young fella, one day I'll play in the NBA, in big text on the thing. And you know, that always stuck with me and I can still see it in my mind when I think about it. And I go, I've got to give it a shot. I'm comfortable financially. I've won ample amounts of championships over here. Let's go give it a shot. And so when the opportunity came, I was like, yep, let's do it. And the rest was history. I jumped on board with Houston and it was kind of like helping out because Yao Ming obviously had an injury that year. And so it was all go then. It was a different different tact, and you know, seeing the NBA it's a different world.
How did the game on the floor, the style of play in the NBA, the style of play in Europe, how did you find the adjustment, and which did you feel was suiting you better?
Well, to be honest, probably European style was more suited to my game. I mean, NBA style is very, I suppose, more athletic and more less tactics, more individualized, you know, playing a lot more thing. And then when someone gets hot, they keep going there. Whereas Europe, they're very strategy, you know, kind of based. And because you have such, you know, deeper rosters, there's a bit more weight in the ball too, I call it. Like, you know, if you miss a shot, you know, in the NBA, you miss one, you keep shooting. That's a good shot. Keep shooting. Bang, bang, bang. Even you go like, you know, 1 of 10 or something. They're like, nah, that's a good shot. Keep shooting. Whereas in Europe, you go 1 of 3, 1 of 4, then the coach is like, nah, you're putting that away. You're not thinking, otherwise you're coming out. So there's a lot more weight on the ball, which I didn't mind because I thrive in pressure situations a bit. And when the game's online, probably for me, it's a bigger, I like big games. So in that sense, America was a different tact. So you kind of had to adjust to it. And bigger bodies, more athletic, harder style. But, you know, I felt like I could have adjusted better. And obviously, funny as it turns out, like big guys stretch fours and stretch fives are all the buzz now. So I was probably 10 years ahead of my time to play NBA, but because we had bigger bodies back then, which are like Shaqs and stuff like that. Mm. So it was a different tack. But I felt I adjusted pretty well, and I did pretty good job in Houston. But obviously, it was a different style of play.
Did you enjoy it?
Like, oh, immensely.
Everything you dreamt of when you're writing things on your wardrobe, is it everything you thought it would be?
Yeah, I mean, it was different. I mean, so in Europe, it's a bit more of a dictatorship, I suppose. Like you go on the road, you've got to eat with the team, you've got to be at the shoot around, you've got this meeting here, you've got to do that. Everything's done with the team, without regard. And if you're not, you get reprimanded pretty harshly. America, it's all individual. Like players go eat by themselves or with a little clue, you know, everything's done individually. Like you're like a true pro, I call it. You gotta do everything yourself. You eat your own food, you choose where you want to eat, what you want to do. And obviously you just got to rock up to the game pretty much and be ready. You can go out night before a game if you want, you can do whatever you want, you know, day of the game. So it was very different in that sense culturally, but for me, it was good. I had some great teammates in Houston as well. Like I had Luis Scola, who was a European pedigree. I mean, Argentinian, but he played in Europe for most of his career. And then Shane Battier was great for me, acclimatizing. I remember Chase, he was a rookie, Chase Buttinger. And we used to always hang out on the road trips and stuff like that. So it was fun. And it's the hype of the NBA is crazy. Like everyone's, you know, every game's pretty much sellouts and everyone loves it. It's a big spectacle. You know, you got the high-flying dunks and all that kind of stuff. It is good, even when you're on the bench, like you got the best seat in the crowd. So you can watch them going at it firsthand. And you see the superstars. Obviously, when you're playing, you forget who they are and you just go at them. But when you put it in perspective, you're like, oh, yeah, these are the big-time ones that you've looked up to all your life. So it does live up to the hype. And it's fun. It's a fun league to be around.
Did you have a moment where you had that NBA logo on your chest and you reflected back to those dreams as a little kid? Like you're 28, 29, you've had an amazing career already, winning EuroLeagues. You're already a two-time Olympian. But did you have a moment where you sort of spoke to your younger self and said, I did it?
Yeah, there's still moments, but in my defend, like I did, I had a lot of those moments and I'm very fortunate. Like a lot of the times I'll be sitting around with family members and going over the accolades and thinking about it, and I go, shit, yeah, this is during it. So I'm going, yeah, but I've always been one of those people who just grabs at opportunities and tries to seize the moment and keep going, you know, never be shy to raise the bar a bit more. So, which is probably like some would say an illness because you're never going to feel like you're happy. But no, I always had moments where I sat still and went, yeah, no, it's been good and great. And a lot of those moments did come along too when I faced like career ending injuries. I'd be like, oh shit, like, you know, this could be the end. You know, I broke my ankle in Russia and I thought that was the end. I thought I ruptured my knee at the same time. That was a horrific injury in Real Madrid. But And those are the times when you kind of look back in the retrospect and go, oh, shit, in hindsight, you go, well, you've done well, Dave, you know, don't be sad because of this. You still, you know, you've achieved a lot. But, yeah, in the NBA, there was a couple of moments you sit down and you go, yeah, geez, we're going at it, like playing in LA. And for, you know, you're like, oh, geez, here we go. And then winning a game in LA, that's one of my big ones. I remember beating the Lakers in LA and I had a huge game, like 17 points and I paused some. And I was like, it was great. You know, we got the victory. It was one of the big ones for Houston, for the Rockets at the time. And I remember Trevor Ariza, who was with the Lakers before, he ended up hosting a little party bus and we went out and had fun. And it was a big time. It was one of those moments then you go, well, geez, like, yeah, this is, you go like, oh, this is what it was all about. All those countless times you're working out in the middle of the night or doing things like crazy times and suffering through workouts and stuff like that.
A party bus.
Yes.
Explain that.
Take us on to the Trevor Ariza party bus.
Party bus. It's like 20.
Yeah, yeah. But take, I know what a, Cam and I know what a party bus is.
Yeah, I know. But
take us on to the Trevor Ariza party bus after you've just beaten the Lakers.
And also, I like the idea that Trevor Ariza, after he won the game, was just like, let's just get a party bus and there's a bus just waiting for you there. I like that idea.
He's big time. He's big time. True. He was big time. I mean, very good teammate, like great guy. So he, yeah, it was just one of those things. He was coming back. So it wasn't like, it was after the game. I think we played kind of early because you play earlier in America too because everything shuts earlier. So so it was just after the game. We all got back to the hotel and Trev was like, he sent out a chat to everyone, message everyone. If you want to come, you know, we'll go to the restaurant and then I've got a bus so we don't have to worry about, you know, driving or getting taxis, things like that. And then we'll go to the clubs after it. And so it was cool. It was like, all right, shit, I'm in. I was a young fella. And like even most of this team came and everyone was there. So it was great to celebrate the game and then, you know, just have some fun and go out and get amongst it. So, but yeah, like a normal kind of thing, like people would do probably for bachelor parties, things like that kind of thing. But Trevor just scrounged on up out of nowhere. Yes, he's got the connections and stuff out there.
See, that's the thing. You're right. Bachelor parties, Barks, Hansie. That's like 6 months of preparation that goes into these things.
Yeah, true.
Not the old, oh, we just beat the Lakers. I got this 40-seater. Let's do this. Love it.
Exactly. That's how they roll butt out there. So, yeah.
Dave, a few years ago, I wrote something about like the 10 best NBA games by Australians. Now, to be honest, most of them have been blown out of the water in the last couple of years by
Ben
and Joe and Patty and those guys have been, and Bainesy.
It's a different era now. Like it's great and it's awesome for Australian basketball.
I wrote about one night of yours for the Rockets against the Jazz. I think 87, 3 of 3 from long range. Was that your best NBA game, do you think?
Yeah, I believe, I think that was in Houston, that game, if I remember right. No, I mean, yeah, they were a formidable team back then too. Like the Jazz were good. So, and we got a big win. And obviously, yeah, when you come out and you're hitting, because it's a deep three-point line too. So for me, it was an adjustment learning how to shoot the NBA three from Europe. Like Europe, this is going back a bit too, so it was even closer. It was an adjustment. So, you know, yeah, had a couple big threes and came out with a big game. And obviously for me, yeah, you remember those ones. And it's like, that's when you feel like you belong a bit, I suppose, once you have one of those games. But the sad thing is a lot of those times you play those massive games and the next day or that same night, you might be jumping on a plane and flying off to the next town for another game. So it was kind of like, there's a big difference. You talk about difference between Europe and America, like, you know, in Europe, you'd beat like a big team. Like with Cesca, we go play Barcelona and we beat them in Barcelona. You could breathe and enjoy it for like a week or even 2 weeks or something like that. In America, you beat the Jazz and then next thing you're on a plane, you're going out to play Chicago or LA or something. It's like you just got to reset your brain and get back to normal because you can't get carried away because it's the same thing back over, which is different. Whereas I remember Europe, we'd win big games and it'd be like, you know, you can party, you can enjoy it, you can... You know, you got to train and you got to play your domestic leagues and stuff like that. But yeah, America is just boom. It's like just a rhythm. You got to be emotionally stable and just keep ticking away. Good one.
This kind of gives a bit of a sense of how much you've done because we're over an hour into this thing and we haven't even got to the Olympics.
Yeah, I didn't know. How long are we supposed to be going with?
Mate, there's a couple of points we've got to get to first, but we are almost going to wrap it up. Four Olympic games. Anytime you slide on a Boomer's jersey, of course, it means so much, but the Olympics is where it's at, mate. Your memories of those four Olympics.
Oh, they're great. I mean, every single one has its own like merits and great times and fun. I mean, yes, I suppose obviously your first one you remember a lot because it's the first time around. So you know, you're getting your feet wet and you're getting into it. So Athens was amazing, like, you know, just seeing it all, absorbing it. Greece, Athens was a bit of shambles. I mean, they weren't the best at organizing in any sense. But yeah, and obviously from the basketball point of view, it probably we didn't do as well as what we hoped to do. We had a tough loss and that kind of set us up badly. But I mean, yeah, for me, it was just getting in, putting on the Aussie jersey was always proud moments for me. I mean, I remember going back to juniors, playing Schweitzer tournaments, green and gold. I remember going 99 junior worlds over in thing, Japan, junior, whatever, to under 22s and 21. And then obviously going to Athens. And a lot of these seasons, a lot of people don't understand. Like they all say, oh, you got to put your jersey on. It's pride of the country and stuff like that. But for a lot of guys, especially ones playing in Europe, you got these long seasons when you win. We finish up June 23rd or something like that. And you got a national team knocking on your door straight away, like saying, oh, come and join us. We got a camp here. And I'm like, bro, we just finished the season. We just won the season. Like, I mean, give me some time to celebrate, get my stuff together and come back to Australia. So, and Athens was one of those years because we won with Siena and the national team were already going. So they were like, you know, and Gorgian was a coach. Luckily, he had some guys like Shane Hill who told Gorge, listen, Dave's pretty good. You know, he's obviously won a championship as MVP of the finals. I think we probably need to make an exception here and bring him on board. And I've been with him previously in the year before qualifying. And then, yeah, so I met up with the team in Europe before the actual everything started. So it was like this, the sacrifice you give of your body and everything like to be a part of the Olympics is quite, you know, hard and everything like that. But it's definitely something I treasured. Athens was probably the one, obviously, the first time around. But in saying that, London was very special in its own right because well organized and probably one of the most probably enjoyable Olympic experiences because we had this like a shopping center next door. So your family could come and we could meet up there. And it was quite good to share with the close people close to you and everything like that. But Rio, obviously coming that close to a medal, it was heartbreaking. And I'm sure you guys saw all the interviews and everything that went around it. And we were so dedicated and so focused on it with the culture. Everything was on point and to come that close was real heartbreaking, but you know, it was a great journey with those guys, those comrades that we played with. It was fun, but yeah, green and gold is definitely a thing that sticks out and probably opportunities along my professional career came about because of what I did with national teams, which is obviously I'm grateful for.
What are your top three Boomers wins of your career? What's the podium?
Ooh, yeah, you put me on the spot here a bit. I mean, probably...
Not necessarily the best, but your favourite.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you want to remember some of the good times. Obviously, starting from the closest Boomers wins, probably in Rio, I would say probably beating France. Because I remember Tony Parker was the boss of our team at that time. I was playing with Asbel. And there was a couple of teammates who were also on that team. So I had a bet with him. And that was a big win for us because it set us up quite well in the whole qualification thing. So that was a high one. And I played pretty well against that. And so it was good times. Probably some of the, even the qualifier, like the one in Melbourne, I believe, I remember the qualifier and it was, it was a tough game because Bogues went down so with a bad back and I stepped up and, you know, and I can still be reprimanded by it because I put a few up and Dre was felt like I was forcing it a bit and wasn't performing when I came on in the first half and reprimanded me a little bit in the locker room. But, you know, and the pressure was on because if we lost, we got to go to New Zealand. It was like it was all on the line in front of a sold out, I think it was Rod Laver Arena even. So it was tough, but then I came in second half and started killing it and ended up like level top scorer with Batty and we obviously beat them and then we went and it was a great victory and it was in Melbourne in front of home fans and I had like, geez, I remember trying to organise the tickets for all my friends that day. It was like 100 of them and it was just a night. It was a bit of a nightmare, but yeah, that was a huge one. That sticks out a little bit in my mind. God, I'm trying to think of other ones. So yeah. There'd be a lot. I've just got to like rack the brain for a while.
You know what? We'll leave it at two because we know there are a lot.
There's a lot. I mean, I'm trying to think. Beijing. Yeah. Yeah. No. Nothing's really sticking out in my mind. I've got to think about it.
Hey, you're not retired.
No, not yet.
2020's been nothing. You mentioned it earlier in limbo, but like, where are you conversations? Is there discussions? Is there possibilities? Where is it when it comes to the future?
Not too much. I mean, obviously, when Gorge was in charge of Hawks for a bit, there was a bit of chat around that. I was working out here with them, but then since then, I think they've fooled the roster and everything. And then this whole coronavirus is throwing everything in limbo. So, and to be honest, like, thinking about it, like the way the scenarios might play out, what might happen with the NBL, I'm not sure. Like, you know, it's different steps in your life. Obviously, as you get older, things take priorities and stuff like that. But for me at the moment, it's just about ticking the body over in doing what we can when we're obviously locked down and keeping everything, you know, just body kind of in a decent shape. And I'm actually might be starting doing a little bit of workouts with the Phoenix coming up because good mate Simon, he's a coach over there. He said you can come over and get tick your body over if you want, you know, see what, you know, you never know, opportunities might pop up. So for me, I'm not, you know, crying about if I don't. I'm not worried if I do. You know, it's more about just ticking along and kind of enjoying. I want to be involved in the basketball game a lot, you know, as with any kind of role, whether that's with the national team, whether it's with an NBL team or with the NBL as an ambassador kind of thing like that. I mean, I want to keep promoting the sport. I feel like basketball in Australia has really taken off from when I came back to Australia in 16. And we're getting great amounts of fans. Everyone talks about it a lot more. We're getting more media coverage, thanks to obviously you guys as well. And it's just, it's going to a whole new level. And Larry has done a great job, and I always applaud him, and I mention him many times because for what he's done in the NBL, I remember going through all the crap and all through the mud, I suppose, is the way to put it. And now it's come back out, and hopefully I'm looking forward to it bouncing back. So I will be involved. I'm not sure what capacity yet.
Good.
But for me, in playing wise, I'll be around. Hopefully, you never know. I can still ride the bike. But like they say, it's just like getting back on the bike. So for me, I will see what happens. But yeah, it's just a matter of waiting to see what opportunities knock, as always.
I'm going to say it right now, Cam. DA is going to be a game-changing mid-season signing by someone as an injury replacement. We know the man is a championship waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be ready to...
Now, see, this is what happens, DA. He gets excited about something, kicks his microphone out. It's a constant thing.
That's all right.
It's the perfect point. That's
someone's going to go down.
Someone's
DA's going to come in. He's going to have big minutes in the fourth quarter of a grand final series game. I'm calling it right now.
Liam's great for him. He's great for my mental state right now. He's making me feel good. So.
Happens, mate, it has been an absolute pleasure watching you, as much as a pleasure to chat to you today, mate. And good luck for the future, whatever it might be, mate. We'll see you soon.
No worries, Cam. Good stuff.
David Anderson, superstar. Hashtag NBL Rewind. If you haven't watched the game yet, make sure you check it out. Get involved. What a time. Liam, Sandy, Maria, I will see you next week on NBL Overtime.
I'll see you.